Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion, was loved by some, envied by many, and hated by many more. Muhammad Ali, once labeled a braggart, a draft dodger, and a fraud, has become a beloved figure and something of an icon. But it can be argued convincingly that no boxer has ever had the impact that Joe Louis had on the American public during his prime in the 30s and 40s. In a new biography titled Joe Louis, Randy Roberts, a professor of history at Purdue University, explores Louis's life and the ways in which he influenced even people who didn't know a hook from a jab before they became aware of the former champion. When I had an opportunity to speak with Randy Roberts recently, I began our conversation by mentioning that early in his book, he seemed to be suggesting that although Louis had very little formal education, the champion was more intelligent than most people thought he was.
I think that's exactly right. You know, Joe Louis, from the very early age, stuttered. And like a lot of kids at that time, because he stuttered, I think people misinterpreted how smart he was. And he didn't like school. He didn't perform well at school. He didn't go to school. He was virtually uneducated, whether it was in Alabama, where he was born, or Detroit, where he moved. He received virtually no education.
Joe Louis found his way into the ring by accident when an amateur boxer, Thurston McKinney, needed a sparring partner. How did that session go?
It didn't go well for Joe at first, but all of a sudden, then Joe connected with a right hand and knocked Thurston down, and Thurston was, he was virtually out on his feet. And Joe Louis discovered, for the first time probably in his life, that there was something that he did exceptionally well. I mean, if you can imagine, here's this guy born at the end of a dusty, dirty, literally a dirt road in Alabama, son of a sharecropper, part of the great migration to the north. He's experienced no success in his life. He's experienced no excellence in his life. And suddenly he discovers that he can hit people really hard. And when he lands a punch, they stay hit.
It's interesting that Thurston McKinney, his first opponent, knew that Louis was taking violin lessons, and his advice was, put that violin away.
The age of the violin ended. He was never much of a violin player. If he had stayed with the violin, I don't think we would have ever heard of Joe Louis.
One of the most important early influences on Joe Louis, the boxer, was a trainer named Jack Blackburn, whom various people described as, quote, a bad guy. How so?
Jack Blackburn was a very bad guy. He had a knife scar that ran from his ear to his lip on his left side of his face. He had served time in prison for murder. He somehow got out of a murder rap a little bit later. He had been a professional boxer. He was basically a quiet guy, but when he drank and he had a problem drinking, he would get very mean. But he loved Joe Louis, and Joe Louis loved him. They called each other Chappie, and they developed a really warm relationship. You have to understand, Joe Louis is going into a world, and it's not the world of the violin, okay? It's a dangerous place. His managers, two managers, one was a leading numbers runner in Chicago. The other was a leading numbers runner in Detroit. You know, this is not a Sunday school world that he's entering into.
Years before anybody had heard of Joe Louis, Jack Johnson had proved that a black man could become heavyweight champion of the world. How did it happen that Louis came to assume such symbolic importance for black Americans?
You know, this is an age where black Americans are not achieving a great deal of excellence, and they're not being recognized for the excellence that they're achieving. You take a person like W.E.B. Du Bois, a great black intellectual. Take a look at the New York Times Index. His name is hardly even mentioned in the New York Times. There was more written in newspapers about Joe Louis in the 1930s than there was about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Okay, I mean, and so here is a person that is a champion. There is nobody better. Joe Louis says to African Americans, you can excel. You can be the absolute best, the best in the world at something.
Louis managed to become the antithesis of Jack Johnson, or at least he was presented to the public that way. He was presented as a happily married man who had nothing to do with white women, which, of course, was part of Jack Johnson's downfall. Yet Lewis was unfaithful to his wife. He was an equal opportunity philanderer by all measures. How was it that the illusion of the champ as a clean-cut All-American was maintained?
Well, this is an age where sports writers had a vested interest in presenting images. You know, sports writers in the 1930s and 1940s, they weren't looking to bring down the idols of sports. They were looking to build them up. I mean, this is the age of Grantland Rice, of the Four Horsemen, of, you know, it's an age where sports writers were part of the process. You know, baseball sports writers, they traveled with the team, they ate free lunches, you know, they weren't going to bite the hand that fed them. It won't be until the 1960s that we'll have this new age of sports writers that are interested in bringing down the heroes.
And when you talk about sports writers and the hands that fed them, the relationship between sports writers and boxing promoters was especially cozy.
Oh, absolutely. The job of the sports writer was to build up a fight, okay, to say exactly what the promoter wanted. The sports writers had their hands out. The boxing promoters, people like Mike Jacobs, they were paying sports writers.
Damon Runyon at one point even owned part of a fighter or three.
Damon Runyon owned not only part of a fighter, he owned part of a promotional company, though nobody knew it, that was going to be promoting a heavyweight champion. So, in essence, by writing good things about the heavyweight champion, he was promoting his own pocketbook.
Joe Louis lost to Max Schmeling in 1936. This was not a championship fight. Why did it become such a big deal?
Joe Louis in 1935, in 1936, he fought a succession of ex-heavyweight champions. He fought Primo Carnera. He fought Max Baer. And now he's fighting Max Schmeling, 1936. It was considered it was going to be another easy fight. Max Schmeling comes over. He knocks Joe Louis out. And now suddenly Max Schmeling is embraced by the Nazi regime in Germany. Max Schmeling becomes the Übermensch, the Superman of Germany. He has lunch with Adolf Hitler. He has tea with Hitler. He watches the Louis Schmeling fight films with Hitler, and Hitler's slapping on himself on his thigh. And so suddenly now this fight, as America and the world is catapulting towards war, this fight takes on real symbolic baggage.
Well, you characterized the second Louis Schmeling fight as, quote, the first time in American history that a black man had been called upon to defend the American way of life. How aware were Louis and Schmeling of the baggage that was being heaped on that fight?
Oh, they were aware. They were aware. There's no question about it. If you picked up a newspaper in Bombay, India, you read about the fight. If you picked up a newspaper in Japan, in Tokyo, it was all about this fight and why that fight was significant to whatever corner of the world was reading about it. Mm.
You include in your biography the famous story about the prisoner being executed in the gas chamber who, with his dying breath, shouted, "Save me, Joe Louis." Is that story true, or does it even matter whether it's true or not?
It's probably not true. It was reported by Martin Luther King in a book that Martin Luther King wrote. But it doesn't matter. The symbolic importance is what matters, is the idea that Joe Louis was viewed in the 1930s for African Americans as a savior. Every day he would receive letters from people asking for this or that. They needed money for an operation. They needed money to keep their apartment or house they were living in. Each letter was an echo of, "Save me, Joe Louis, save me, Joe Louis."
Speaking of the requests that he received, he was a generous guy.
Oh, he was overly generous. Joe Louis just frittered money away, gave money away. There's a great story told towards the end of Louis's life. He was a greeter in Vegas, and he was talking with Billy Kahn, a great Pittsburgh fighter who he had fought. They had a fantastic fight in 1941. And anyway, a guy comes up, panhandles Joe Louis, and Joe Louis has some green chips and black chips. Green chips were worth like $25. Black chips were worth $100. And so Joe Louis gives the guy a handful of black chips. And Billy Kahn says, "Joe, what are you doing? You're being a schmuck. That guy was panhandling you. What he told you was a bunch of bull." And Lewis says, yeah, I know. I was just going to lose it anyway. You know, that's the way Lewis treated money. I'm just going to lose it anyway. I might as well give it away. In his prime, he would leave his house in the morning. He might have $300-$400 in his pocket. By noon, he'd be broke.
During the Second World War, Joe Lewis, who was already way behind on his taxes, donated purses to the war effort, essentially fought for free. Did his willingness to do that have any impact on his debt to the IRS?
None. Because here's this guy, he risks his title twice, once in 1941, once in early 1942. And then he donates all the money to the government, but the government says, look, you know, you owe the tax man. It's like that Beatles song about the tax man. You owe the tax man, and there's going to be no relief. And if you don't pay it back, we're charging you interest. We're charging you whatever we can charge you.
Like a lot of boxers, Joe Lewis stayed in the ring too long, in large part because he had incurred tremendous debts. But based on what you've written, I gather that no matter how big the purses for his last fights might have been, Lewis couldn't have made much of a dent in his debt to the IRS. Couldn't somebody in his corner have figured that out and perhaps at least saved Lewis some damage?
Well, the question presupposes that boxing has a heart and that managers have hearts. It's not the way the game plays. I mean, take a look at Muhammad Ali today. Take a look at so many boxers. They all fought one or two or ten too many fights. Of course their managers could say it, but as long as there's a payday, there's always a promoter, there's always a manager that's going to take advantage of it.
Much has been written about Joe Lewis's last years when he began using drugs, survived on the charity of casino owners in Las Vegas, and endured terrifying episodes of paranoia as well. Did you make a conscious choice to limit your consideration of Joe Lewis's last decade or so?
Yes, I did. I was interested in Joe Lewis in his prime. I was interested in Joe Lewis when he meant so much to so many Americans. I didn't want to dwell on the Joe Lewis after he retired, the Joe Lewis that had the drug problems. I talk about his drug problems, but I don't think there's any need to belabor the point. I don't think Joe Lewis, though, at the end, when he was a greeter in Vegas, he never felt sad for himself. You know, he thought being a greeter was a great job. You know, he played golf every day, and he loved playing golf. He had his place to stay on the Caesars grounds. He would gamble with people. He loved talking with people. He was a gregarious guy. And so I don't view the end of Joe Lewis's life as particularly sad.
Is it fair to say, regarding those last few years, that he was just very badly served by a country that he had served rather well?
I think so. Suddenly, a new type of black athlete was emerging. You know, proud, defiant, articulate. You know, a person like Jim Brown in football or Muhammad Ali. Joe Lewis wasn't that type of an athlete. So it's as if America forgot about him. There's a one great story that Bob Lipsight told me. And it was right before the Sonny Liston-Muhammad Ali fight. And everybody was talking with Muhammad Ali. And all of a sudden, Joe Lewis came in. And all the old reporters, the Red Smith, the famous old reporters, go over to Lewis. And afterwards, Lipsight rounded up one of the reporters and he said, you know, what are you doing? You know, why are you going with that old man? The story is right here. It's Cassius Clay at that time. This is the story. And the reporter looked at Lipsight and said, oh, you should have seen him when. The world passed Lewis by, but the memory lived on.
My conversation with Randy Roberts, the author of Joe Lewis, will be featured in this week's program. We'll also be taking a look at the playoff picture in the NFL. Within the frame of that alleged masterpiece, there will be one team that's 500 or worse. We'll have a story about the renovated Rose Bowl, where TCU will be playing Wisconsin on New Year's Day. If the Rose Bowl is, in fact, the granddaddy of them all, as the cliche suggests, then what fun that granddad's getting a facelift. For those who prefer a game where the ball is round, only a game's Doug Tribou will have a story about former NBA star Antoine Walker's attempt to reclaim his career via a stint in the NBA's Development League. So join us and remember you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.